I want to tell you what it's like living with a leading. It seems to me that the most important thing I can do with this opportunity is to share with you what it has done for my life, how it's changed me, how it has guided me in my work, how it has developed my understanding of the human condition and of my faith and my relationship with God. I hope that my story will shed light on how we as individual friends and as meetings can share with one another and help each other as we become instruments for God's work in the world. I also want to share with you what my leading was about. In the words of our peace testimony, the spirit by which we are guided is not changeable, so as once to command us to do something and then to move against it. We believe that God's guidance is one thing, is united, is present in all of us. And so a leading in any of us is a message for all of us, something for us to work with and to find the way forward in unity. When one of us has a clear sense of God's guidance, this makes such an important message that I feel I am accountable to the meeting and I am accountable to this meeting to tell you about it. So I want to challenge you with some of my views about some deeply important areas of social witness and of service, namely the right and proper relationship with children and young people. This work sprang from my Quaker faith and has its roots so deeply in the Quaker testimonies that there are inspiring parallels, which I've found, between the dilemmas of early friends and their relationships with children and young people, and what we feel today, both as older friends and as younger friends. It's a Quaker tradition to tell our personal stories as a way of supporting and helping each other with our struggles and with our efforts to keep open to the Spirit. This isn't a sign of self-centeredness. We're not centered on ourselves. We are centered on the divine presence within. And telling our own stories is simply the best way we can to explain how we experience the real and powerful guidance which speaks directly to us and yet is beyond words and beyond human understanding. The word for this in my native language is God, and it serves me well enough. As my faith has strengthened, I have become less cautious about the use of the word God and more adventurous in exploring its meanings. The most important thing I want to share with you is that we can trust the workings of the Spirit even when we don't understand it. It will not lead us into untruth. We can trust our inward promptings and leadings, and we can plunge on. We do not need to harbor fear, for although we've much to learn, the Spirit can be utterly relied on to guide us both as individuals and as meetings, and it will give us endlessly renewing love. Early Quakers grew up in an atmosphere of fear. They lived through terrible violence, violence which was in the country politically and also a sort of culture of domestic violence and general community violence. But their deepest fears were about sin and salvation. It will help our own struggle with fear to understand what it was like for them. They worried very much about their children and young people. They worried about who they spoke to, who they mixed with, how they spoke, and what they wore. It sounds really familiar, doesn't it? They expressed rising concern about the way their young people wanted to wear fashionable clothes, liked buttons and braids and ruffles and tucks and naked necks and naked backs. But they saw their beloved young friends degenerating into pride and height of spirit, note that phrase, and apparel. Of course, speech and clothing were very important forms of witness to early friends, and they became a great source of tension between friends of the younger and the older sort. It took the age of standardized mass-produced clothing and an understanding of young psychology for Quakers to stop seeing the adventurously dressed and decorated young person as turning away from the truth. When I speak of the inner promptings and leadings of the Spirit, I'm asking us to trust these processes in children and young people in exactly the same way, for the Spirit is as present and as active in them as it is in anyone. By recognizing and acting on this, I believe that we will learn to share and care for one another and serve the wider world in ways which are inaccessible to us now. So let me tell you my story of being led. I want to start with a quotation from the inspiring writings of George Fox the Younger. Now, you may not have heard of him. George Fox the Younger was actually older than George Fox, the founder of our faith. He was called George Fox the Younger because he was convinced more recently, and therefore he was regarded as spiritually younger. As you can see, early friends had a very different approach to the issue of chronological age. Anyway, in 1669, this George Fox wrote, "As you wait in the light, you will come to feel God's pure, powerful presence, and life and virtue running through you, which will refresh the seed. Your whole delight will be to walk in the truth, and you will feel God's power drawing and leading you into whatsoever he requireth you to do. And as you wait and are still, you will clearly come to discern that which the Lord doth not require you to act." When I perceived the inward imperative to work for the human rights of children, it was so strong, so all-encompassing, that I felt as if the universe was waiting for me to act. It seemed that everything I'd done, all the skills I'd acquired, were in living connectedness, and my life was making sense as it had never done before. It seemed to me as if there was something about my presence on earth, my abilities, my time, that were precious to God. The process started in 1986 when I found some UN guidelines for intercountry adoption. These helped my husband and I to decide how to proceed with our wish to adopt a child. At that time, inter-country adoption was very controversial, and many of the criticisms of it resonated with us. We were concerned about getting it right. This UN document, which was quite short, gave us a set of steps that would protect the interests of the child. It answered our concerns, and it showed us a way forward which was ethically acceptable. Soon after that, I read the draft of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, and it filled me with inspiration because of the comprehensive view that it had of a peaceful, nurturing world for all children everywhere. Over the next year or so, I read everything I could about what was happening to children around the world. I became aware of horrific patterns of child labour, child abandonment, child trafficking, child sex tourism, and dreadful treatment of children in the juvenile justice system or even in the adult justice system. Most of this information came from a young Geneva-based international NGO, Defence for Children International, which had been formed specifically to promote and protect the human rights of children. I became very active in advocating children's rights in relation to adoption. And in 1992, I was asked to set up the section of DCI in Australia. My sense of being moved to do this work grew as I saw the urgent need for it, and as I learned about the human rights system and what was being done. One afternoon, after a meeting at the Human Rights Commission in Sydney, I took a ride on a harbour ferry. As I was carried among the beauty and brilliant wealth of that city, I was overwhelmed with images of suffering children all around the world and just across the water. And I wept with the conviction that this was what I must do, and somehow it would be resourced. This experience came from outside me, but also deeply within me. And it contained a curious duality of values. On the one hand, my life and human achievements seemed not to matter at all. And yet, doing God's work was utterly, passionately desired. In this lies a real-life dilemma. How open should one be to giving up on existing relationships and commitments? There was, for me, no opting out of the leading, and I had no doubt that my family would have to bear what could not be avoided. I set up an office at home, travelled a lot, and worked to build the DCI section in Australia, more or less full-time, for quite a few years. Fortunately, my family seemed to absorb some of the sense of purpose too, and they developed tolerant adaptations to my travelling and my unpredictable states of mind. I was and am grateful for the gentle upholding of the whole family by the Spirit. I came to refer to it as my work, not volunteering, because that is how I saw it. It was not necessary for me to bring home to the family an income, and in this I was privileged, for it enabled the way in which my leading developed. The long-standing Quaker tradition of releasing friends by providing basic financial support and childcare when needed is not strong for us, and it's to our loss, for it is our leadings which are the bridge between our spiritual life and our social witness. Early friends used vivid, earthy language to communicate how they experienced God's guidance. Truth lodged in their hearts, not in their minds or their heads. They felt God's tender love in their bowels, we might say gut feelings. They were certain that the spiritual life had physical reality and power. But we feel we must always acknowledge the possibility of being wrong. We venture into strong descriptions with much more caution. Yet rational language and intellectualized concepts put up tough defenses against the very process that we treasure and seek. From our deepest being, using all the forces of creation, the Spirit pushes itself into our awareness and demands our complete attention. The day turns dark. We cannot move. Our throat locks up. We shiver. We weep. How else is the power that is beyond words to communicate with us? God calls us through our bodies, breaking through the defenses of our minds, and we respond with emotion. When we dismiss these as passing sensations, or as meaningless or irrational, we turn away from God. Of course, they will pass, and so will the lights therein if we don't recognize them. My sense of being led was renewed by vivid images, powerful dreams, and plunging emotions. It was as if I was being made alive again and again to the deepest meaning of my being, each time experiencing it as new. I'm still in awe of that amazing process. It's mysterious. It changed me as a human being. But the truth did not change. The same core insights kept recurring, so that my inspiration was refreshed and my energies renewed. Quaker faith is deeply rooted in the idea of heaven on earth. It was only recently that I realized that I had been drawn to the human rights system, human rights work, because it resonates with the same principles that I value so much in Quakerism. We Quakers strenuously avoid doing harm or interfering in individual lives. We choose first to protect individual freedom and then to create a safe environment so that each one, on an equal basis, can live out their lives, follow their spiritual journey in dignity and in peace. Human rights treaties are inspiring and useful because they present a vision to us for humanity which is inclusive, peaceful, caring, and just. They transcend human differences in the spirit of equality, and they underpin human differences in the spirit of tolerance and freedom. They offer me personal guidance on how to work for heaven on earth. However, I do think that there are many Quakers, maybe only some Quakers, who feel uncomfortable with the human rights approach. We have a strong historical resistance to creedal statements and to written rules. The human rights system seems overly concerned with words and with legal methods, legal processes. We prefer the soft feel of voluntary generosity and gentle persuasion. Well, I'm rather like that too. I picked up on the human rights language because it gives clarity to the minimum acceptable standards for behavior between people. They are forthright about right and wrong in human relationships, and they carry the weight of agreement of countries all around the world, of all cultures, economic circumstances, and religions. Through them, we can see a bigger and more vivid picture of the future, and they can alert us to things that we might otherwise ignore. Let me give you some examples. There are some people here that are starving. Is this because they belong to a marginalized ethnic group which the government systematically ignores? This family is destitute. Is it because a parent was given no legal defense in court and is now serving a prison sentence for which they're not guilty? Here is a new road. Is it going to open up an isolated community to child traffickers? Business loans are being offered to poor families. Does this mean that children will be taken out of school for their labor? Here is a school, a childcare center, or a children's home, and they're asking for support. It seems incontrovertible that we would help them. But do they use physical punishment? Do they turn a blind eye to sexual abuse of children? In all of these cases, how do we protect the children? The worst human suffering is not due simply to lack of necessities. It is due to discrimination, institutional violence, and a weak or oppressive legal system. The best way forward is for us to take note of those things and to work on them. And the best way forward for us to protect children is to engage in discussions with them. Indeed, the best way to leave them vulnerable is not to do so. We can stand by them and we can help them defend themselves. In the early years of this work, I was on a steep learning curve. The clarity I felt about the vision was often accompanied by chronic uncertainty about what to actually do and whether I was really able to do it. People commented on my dogged persistence. I think now that that's probably the defining symptom of being led, a seemingly extraordinary persistence which pays no regard to human measures of achievement and is not shaken by the non-appearance of outcomes in the world. I looked to friends for opening and support. For me, there was a continuous flow between listening to the Spirit in meeting, my private prayers, and what I was being drawn to do with all my time. In February 1994, I asked my business meeting for its support, not really knowing what I meant. My meeting responded with caution and doubt. Friends were already too busy. This was not what they normally do. You know, the sort of thing. But I felt as if the meeting was tearing itself away from me. And there, in the back of the meeting, I could do nothing else but curl up in pain and weep. Friends are indeed very busy, both for their meeting and out in the world. And the first and foremost work of a meeting is to nurture the spiritual life and worship of the community. Any social action by a meeting must spring out of that corporate unity. I knew all that, and yet I felt abandoned. When the clerk saw my despair, she put the matter to the meeting again. And this time the meeting offered a period of worship sharing later, and later after that a small personal support group was set up. I was very grateful for those moves. But the absence of a clear connection between what I was working on and my faith community made me feel spiritually disorientated and reticent about taking friends' time or making further requests. Somehow it seemed illegitimate to push my barrow among friends. Individual friends were encouraging and interested, but I developed a deep dread of being knocked back corporately. It seems that this private drive I had from God was not for me to proselytize among friends or be dependent on friends for doing it. Sometimes I sank into fearful self-examination. Having lived under a sense of spiritual certainty for a while, this re-emergence of doubt felt like being swept about by gusts of wind with no sense of where the ground was. I needed help from friends to stop a rising fear of having been abandoned by God as well. The meeting for worship and individual friends helped me through these times. After some 10 years or so, I began to question whether my dogged persistence had really become a form of pride. Maybe, I thought, I'm really being driven by a covert search for recognition and praise. Or maybe I simply can't abide the idea of failure. In 2001, I was sobbing desperately about the ineffectiveness of my work, when suddenly I gave a resigned sigh. "Maybe it doesn't matter," I said. It was a huge relief. It was a grace, something I couldn't have done humanly. I had acknowledged the desire for success in human terms had been hanging around my mind, and I had pushed it aside. My sense of being led found a new balance with my awareness of oh-so-human limitations. Gradually, however, I did become clear that my leading had become old. My sense of unshakable rightness and my ability to persist faded. I came back to earth, as it were, and I knew that the condition had passed. I still feel a deep concern for the rights of children. I get ideas and I get inward promptings, but the condition is quite different. So it appears to me that there are a range of divine communications which we are able to receive individually when we are open enough. There is light which we can receive, which is always there, giving us insight into what is right and true. There are moments of connectedness which happen involuntarily and give us love and personal validation. There are promptings which niggle away in our conscience relating to shame and guilt, and in our heart relating to longings and visions. There are leadings which are specific and personal and painful to deny. And there are concerns which have an enduring sense of rightness in a very broad sense. We do have the power to shut ourselves off from these, but it wounds our spirit to do so, and it breaks our connection with God. It is essential that we take these sensations very seriously indeed, that we trust them, that we pray in them, that we wait in them, and that we pay close attention to the openings that do happen, whatever anyone else may think. In the early years of my work, I met a lot of defensiveness and anxiety in other people about the idea of children having rights, among friends as well as teachers, social workers, and neighbors. Many people seemed to get raised hackles when I spoke about my work. As long as I referred to distant long suffering, terrible suffering, it was okay. But as soon as I framed it in the terms of the status of children in our own community and our own families' lives, people found it threatening. And indeed it is. The recognition of children as equal human beings, not of less value because they're young, not automatically subordinate to adults, not the private property of parents, but fully entitled to participate and be enabled to act in the whole of community life, will have as much social impact as the women's movement has, as workers' rights have, and as minority rights are having. George Fox's famous advice to greet that of God in every man was not meant by him to exclude women and children. His writings are consistently inclusive. Today we often replace Fox's use of the word man with everyone. Another important Quaker advice is to be open to the light from wherever it may come. When we use the word everyone or wherever, do we include children and young people in the little mental pictures that flash through our minds? Do you, like me, usually have an image in your head of people who are all the same size as yourself and who have basically the same way of communicating what they experience? This is a familiar trap to me, and it often takes a child or a young person to correct me and keep me more inclusive. As Quakers, the most important thing we can do for our children is to have faith in their inward light and to trust them as they follow it. This means having corporate worship in forms which are interesting to children and young people, and giving time to finding corporate unity with them about the things that they care about. We must also protect children and young people from all forms of violence. Our peace testimony is not simply a testimony against war. It sprang from early friends' clarity that all interpersonal violence is wrong because it wounds our connection with the spirit. Violence against children communicates to them an utterly wrong message about their place in the world. This issue is of deep spiritual significance to us. Earlier this year, I started some research into early Quaker relationships with children and young people. I sort of wanted to trace the roots of my own concern in this area. I wanted to find out what was the history of it, and whether, in fact, there were insights which would come from our history. I found a truly fabulous mixture of pure, radical insight and deep-seated fear, which led to such an anxious controversy about child-rearing that friends retreated into what we know as the quietest period. Early friends were convinced that children were born innocent and endowed with the inner light. True ministry could flow from child to adult, as well as from adult to child. Since each child was being guided by God, many parents felt they should not interfere with God's work in the child. It was a sort of hands-off approach, which one modern historian has called virtual parental passivity. But that's the sort of comment that non-Quaker academics make about Quakerism. What it really was an extraordinary, egalitarian, and trusting approach to child rearing that was being advocated alongside gentle, patient, meek relationships in all situations. I think it was very likely that many early Quaker parents stopped using physical punishment with their children, even though they had no models of what to do instead. And we have to remember that at that time, the physical punishment of children was regarded as an essential aspect of child rearing. So what did this radical, marvelous opening do? It grew up a generation of confident, adventurous, vocal young people, and very bolshy they were too. By the late 1660s, there was a growing concern about the behavior of Friends' children. George Fox expressed the view that some Quaker children were worse than many of those in the world, more loose, stubborn, and disobedient. The early Friends were unable to recast their understanding of what behavior was sinful, and their literal images of God's punishment. So the only way forward for them was to protect children from temptation. Friends turned back to the approach of their own parents, albeit softened by the principle of innocence and restrained by seeing the light in their children. Obedience to parents, and hence the approved use of physical punishment as a last resort, came gradually and, I suspect, painfully reinserted into Quaker parenting. This happened after only one generation. By the end of a tumultuous century, some leading Friends were advocating strict parental discipline to save their children from sin. It was argued that parents' light was the primary channel for God's guidance to the child. No longer was the child's own light sufficient. Parents could impose their light on their children, and the child's light would lead them to obey. However, if a child didn't obey, then he or she would not be following the inward light and therefore needed to be punished. This question of how to rear children in truth and how to deal with unacceptable behavior became a compelling concern for Friends. It recurred in every yearly meeting, or nearly every yearly meeting epistle, for the next 50 years. And it still is a compelling question for us. Friends avoided adopting a clear opposition to physical punishment by refusing to define it as violence. But instead, they introduced many rules of community and family life which were designed to protect their children from the temptations of the world. This was so that punishment would not be necessary. Today, we have the benefit of much better understanding of child development and the importance of adolescent adventurousness, and we're not terrified by images of a punitive God. This issue of obedience is crucial, really. The early Friends had it right. Our deep obedience is only to God, not to human authority. This is what we can nurture in our children, not obedience to human authority, but their development of lots and lots of spirit. The same principle applies to our own being led. Although it is an experience of great clarity and certainty, it does not confer any authority in the world or in the meeting. In particular, it shouldn't give rise to expectations of support and cooperation with the led individual. While I was experiencing powerful surges of enthusiasm and intense focus, I never felt it possible to say, God has led me to ask you to do this with me, or God wants you to do this. I knew that I must remain respectful and loving towards the Spirit's work in others, which may be leading them to hold different priorities. Nevertheless, I think it's very important indeed to seek unity with the meeting. We are accountable to the meeting, and the meeting is the best place for us to explore what is happening to us without fear. Meetings can be instrumental in protecting and nurturing a leading which might otherwise be starved by doubt or shrivel under the unsympathetic glare of the world. Friends will be most helpful if they respond with acceptance, trust, and respect, whether they feel personally moved by the leading or not. The meeting may not need to do much more than offer love and continuing interest, which is what I consistently receive from my meeting. Or it may extend to adopting the leading formally as a meeting concern. But whichever way the meeting decides to go, I feel that it is very important that friends' leadings are recognized as part of the business of the meeting and are given prayerful consideration from time to time. This is the most important thing we can do for each other, to describe our inward experiences and explore together how we are guided to live. It's what the earliest meetings for worship were all about. It's why they lasted for hours, and it's why they were interesting to children and young people and many, many seekers. Let us cast off the taboo against certainty, expressing certainty and emotion. Let us use strong metaphors and vivid language in the way in which we speak about what we experience within. I've no doubt that we will continue sharing our doubts and failings with one another. That part of sharing our spiritual lives seems easy. But let us not be afraid of sharing our certainties adventurously too. And when we're confronted with the symptoms of a leading in others or in ourself, let us rejoice at the nearness of God. Let us share it with all, and let us seek a true and loving unity in following it.